3RPH is pleased to present the memoirs of Tilly Aston, Australia's blind poet, author and philanthropist. The story told of the many-faceted life of this talented woman is intriguing. The memoirs of Tilly Aston is published by Hawthorne Press and read by Pamela Adams. Episode 12.
Literary work resumed. It is well known that one of the regulations of the public services is the condition that all employees must abstain from engaging in any other work which brings remuneration. When I entered the education department, I took the regulation seriously and relinquished any literary works I might have secured, because the regularity and security of my new income seemed a better prospect for me. For some time before my appointment, I had been contributing short stories to the Weekly Times, historical sketches to the Spectator, as well as occasional poems and articles and sketches to other papers at home and abroad. Financial results had never been very encouraging. Therefore, I experienced little regret when the years went by with scarcely a line of original writing, save a children's tale now and then, which went no further than my own scholars. But once more the urge to write awoke within me. Little songs and lyrics stole onto stray sheets of paper, and such expressions of my love of goodness and beauty began to pile up. At last, in 1923, the plans for a small booklet came to the surface. I would pay all costs myself and send out the modest collection as a Christmas gift to my friends. During the period which had elapsed since the last appearance of my name as an author, I had been practically forgotten and had lost my place and standing. Nevertheless, conscious that I could not sustain the hardships of my position much longer, I wanted to remind folk that I still hoped and desired to contribute something to the literature of my country. So I made a selection of the lyrics on hand, typed them, and under the title of Singable Songs, had them printed by Robertson and Mullins in time for Christmas posting. I needed about 100, but found that I could get 500 for a small extra sum. The 500 edition was ordered, and I trusted to be able to sell all the surplus copies. In this I was not disappointed. The little book captured the fancy of many. The press, too, gave it friendly notices, and the whole edition went out within a few weeks. The printing cost me £29, and I sold £30 worth, so that I came out of the transaction fairly recouped, considering I had used all I needed myself without including them in the sales. This was not the end of Singable Songs, however. When a year or so later my health broke down, the Association for the Advancement of the Blind wanted to help me to adjust my finances. I have mentioned what an objection I had to such a course. To have founded and led an organization for the uplift of my fellows, to have been its spirit and essence so far, only to fall back on it for personal benefits, was utterly repugnant to me. Then they wanted to get up a benefit concert for me, which seemed the same thing under a different name. Finally, they offered among them to sell my little book. I gave in, and a 5,000 edition was printed, to be sold at a shilling each. And in this manner, Singable Songs was broadcast all over Victoria. I fear it did not bring me much literary prestige, but at least it was my own work, and from the sales I received some money, and it was much needed. Whatever the sentiment of those who sold and those who bought, this little brochure, I try to forget that it may have been pure charity. I was actually too ill to take much interest in the matter at the time. Yet to this hour I am profoundly grateful to all who desired to assist me over a period of deep distress, and it has been a spur to my endeavours of better days to bring to the blind my offering of service. During the long, weary years of my slow recovery, I had plenty of leisure for thought. As soon as I was able, I read more and began to write, making some efforts to regain the ground I had lost in journals and magazines. It appeared to me, by the results, that I had lost my skill, that my outlook was old-fashioned, my style too quiet and homely and lacking thrill. I attempted a work of fiction, saturated with the atmosphere of early pioneering life, built up by my mother and by the odd folk living about us in my childhood. I sent this book to a leading editor, who was using serial stories at the time. He returned it with a kind letter, stating that he had read it with pleasure, that it was a good tale with a definite historical value, and that he hoped I would try to get it published in book form, although it was not the type for the serial page, too quiet to carry readers on from break to break. Later, I tried it on an English publisher, whose objection was that the intense local colouring would not suit the English reader. Thus, much-travelled Grand Commander is still at home in the haven of my rejects, and probably will never see the printing press. At the same time, I kept on with my lyric writing, and as no other door seemed to have a key for me, I decided to venture some poetry once more. Having made a selection, I grouped them into sets, one for each month of the year, and with a little calendar poem at the beginning of the set and a flower picture at the end, I thought I had a nice little volume, which I named Songs of Light. I sent this to the Lothian Publishing Company, without indicating that I was handicapped with blindness. At length came a letter asking me to call, as my book was under favourable consideration. I went in a painful flutter, and was received by Mr. Arthur Greening, the manager. His surprise was great when he discovered my disability, and on my part there was much heart-sinking when I remembered how apt is the businessman in general to limit his estimate of the attainments of such as I. I felt the colour leave my face, but Mr. Greening, the friendliest of souls, went on to reassure me, saying that the head of the firm considered the volume one of the most interesting he had handled for a long time. It was suggested that the book would be improved if I added a brief autobiographical sketch with a picture of the author, so this was done. Further, in earlier years, I had sent a copy of Singable Songs to Miss Helen Keller, the distinguished American woman, who has overcome so much through blind and deaf. Among other letters from her, there was one especially commending my little effort, and I showed it to Mr. Greening at once, and he said, "This must also go into the Song of Light," and I wrote to Miss Keller for permission to use it, which was cordially granted. My book was now ready for the printer, but there was still the financing to face. £150 must be found, and I had to be personally responsible for every penny. Again, I resorted to the subscription method, with such success that in a month or two I had enough orders in advance to ensure a reasonable hope that I should not lose on the venture. Songs of Light appeared through Barron in London and through Lothian in Melbourne, in the year 1935. The response of the press was surprisingly good. Looking back through my press cuttings, I can feel the warmth and admiration which my poems inspired. They brought around me many friendly acquaintances, loyal and sincere, and since that time I have generally been known as Australia's blind poet. Most of the edition is now in circulation, and though the profits were negligible, I lost nothing and gained what I wanted more than money, some prestige as a writer. It is hardly necessary to state here that my fate is that of all who long to be the song-makers of the people. We sing because we cannot help it. The publisher, the printer, the bookbinder, the carrier, and the man who sells the product all get their pay, but the poet will have to be, like myself, only too thankful if he can find a listener and satisfied to create and record the things of beauty he discovers for himself. Yet I have been more fortunate than most, inasmuch as I have not lost my scanty coin over getting a modest circle of readers. Songs of Light served me in other ways. It was noticed favourably in some quarters of the English press, and a copy sent to Queen Mary by the London publishers brought a charming reply from her secretary, of which I possess a photostat copy. Many other cherished letters have come to me through this and my later books. Perhaps I was most gratified by that sent by Douglas Sladen, the great English author and critic. It appears on the flyleaf of a copy of his own book on Adam Lindsay Gordon, which Mr. Sladen sent me as a present. The distinguished writer assured me that he thought my work far above most Australian writing he had read, and should ultimately assure a place for itself in the literary records of my own land. I trust his words may come true. At any rate, they made the humble author of Songs of Light very happy at the time. And in brackets here, it says, see the reproduction of Mr. Sladen's gift letter, which we will read later. There was another outcome of this publication, which I must record. A few months after its appearance, I received a note to call on my publishers, and Mr. Greening told me that an inquiry was being made concerning my former literary work, and also in regard to my circumstances, etc. We had a chat, and I left him with the understanding that I might hear more of this later. One morning, the post brought me a letter, stating that I had been nominated for an award for the Commonwealth Literary Fund, and asking for a complete list of my published works, my age and nationality. The information was supplied, and in due time I was notified that my nomination by the Melbourne Committee was confirmed, and that I would receive a literary pension for life. In all my dealings with the publisher, I had met only the manager, but I learned that Mr. Lothian himself had moved in this matter, and to him my fervent acknowledgments are tendered here. This fund, as is well known, was instituted for the purpose of easing up the lot of our Australian authors. It is necessary that the candidate shall have contributed something really worthwhile to the literature of this country, and in this way it is an award as well as financial bounty. It is also meant to enable the struggling writer to continue producing under conditions less harassing than they would be without the pension, and that has been so in my case. A recent increase in the weekly amount adds much to its effectiveness. It will be seen, therefore, that even if my books come out just paying their way, the financial result is more satisfactory than appears on first account. And now we read the letter from the English critic, Mr. Douglas Sladen. To Tilly Aston, the most brilliant blind woman in the world, who in the 7 years of childhood, during which sight was vouchsafed to her, learned of mankind what others learn in a lifetime. She knows nature and human nature as well as if she saw them with her eyes, and has a most delightful way of expressing her opinions to those who see with their eyes. She is a beautiful poet and a faithful writer of stories. Signed, Douglas Sladen. One of the less important activities of my later years was in connection with the Mission to Blind in Heathen and Bible Lands, founded by an invalid blind man named Robert Byers, and still functioning, as far as the war will permit, from its office in Queen Street, Melbourne. Soon after I had settled in my new home at Raleigh Street, Windsor, I was invited to resume Sunday school teaching, a branch of Christian work which had always claimed my services. Mr. Richard Reynolds was at that period superintendent of the Methodist school in Upton Road, and he urged me to form a class for the young women, because the girls, as they grew up, drifted away, leaving no young people from which to draw the necessary junior teachers. So I took on this work and continued it for about 10 years, until broken health tied me down to my own house. Very early in our acquaintance, Mr. Reynolds introduced me to another sphere of service. Opposite the Sunday school lived Mr. Robert Byers, a man just about 40, around whom arthritis had cast its iron chains. Every joint of his body was rigid, and blindness wrapped him in total darkness. Mr. Reynolds took me to visit this sad case, and it became my weekly practice to spend an hour with him. I found him brave and cheerful, and obsessed with a fixed purpose to do something for other blind people. He had heard much about the sufferings of the blind in China and other countries of the Orient, and it had occurred to him that we might be able to do a little towards the alleviation of their lot, to bring the gospel to them, and incidentally, to aid in their education. Several missionaries had started small schools for their sightless charges, and to aid them financially, Mr. Byers started a birthday league, sending greetings to each member at the birthday anniversary, and asking for gifts for this special missionary cause, even if it were only a shilling. Although Mr. Byers has long ago thrown off his fetters of pain, the organization he set up still flourishes as a memorial to his courage, under the guidance of Miss Muriel Layton. Of course, this terribly handicapped man could not do his own writing, and a band of helpers took it in turn to spend half a day a week in the sick room carrying out his directions about letters, records, and the dispatch of what sums he was able to gather for the support of children in the foreign field. In this work I shared and often marvelled at the alertness and far-sightedness of the man on the bed. His brain was active at all times, and his rare sense of humour made one forget the extent of his disabilities, which gripped him. Before he died, he had the satisfaction of seeing his mission well established and supporting a number of children in the various schools for the blind in India and China, and calls for help coming from the ancient lands of Egypt, Syria, and Palestine. At the time of Mr. Byer's death, I was myself laid aside with the illness that followed my retirement from teaching, so that I could not undertake any outdoor duties in connection with this matter. But there was a job for me which seemed essential, and which I felt might be managed while I waited my returning health. A pressing need in the schools where the subjects of our care were being educated was reading matter of a kind suitable to young Christian students, not so easy to find as one would imagine. Books in circulation for our own children were often undesirable for these new converts to the faith of our Lord Jesus, and Mrs. Layton consulted me concerning a choice of material. I proposed that to meet the special need, we might produce a small annual volume on the lines of a magazine, in which every article could be carefully written or edited for our own purpose. The idea seemed good, and the services of a few voluntary Braille transcribers were enlisted to multiply copies. Printing it in embossed type was out of the question. My part was to write the book, preparing the first sheets from which duplicates could be made. It consisted of about 9,000 words, and as it was a gift from Australia to the blind of other lands, I named it The Book of Opals. I had in mind a threefold aim in the selection and preparation of material. First, it should keep to the fore faith in Jesus Christ, our Saviour, and build up the principles of the Christian religion, as well as stimulate the spiritual life of the young readers. Second, it should furnish some help towards a sound education on right lines, and entertain wholesomely those for whom pleasures were few. Third, it must be Australian, and contribute some enlightenment concerning this far country to the eager people of the East. To effect these three objects, it always contained some devotional reading, such as a heart-to-heart talk on some theme that I hoped would stir the spiritual aspirations of the sightless recipients. A selection of well-beloved hymns, an Old Testament story, Old Testament because I knew that all the schools have the Gospels in Braille. To these I would add some daily texts, a short prayer or two, and a poem of some kind, with the distinctly Australian side represented by articles on our flora and fauna. A story of pioneering days, or of exploration from our earlier history. There would also be a trifle for playtime, such as a biblical alphabet, a few riddles, or a guessing game. It will be seen that the whole book had to be practically original writing, and it occupied a fair amount of time, besides keeping me on the lookout all the year for just the right items of interest. Letters from India, China, and Japan satisfied me that my efforts were appreciated. On one occasion, the little book was printed in Braille, I understand, and circulated to the Christian students of English in some Japanese schools. For 12 consecutive years, I carried out the duties of editor and chief contributor of the Book of Opals, and I have to acknowledge that this voluntary service gave me a great deal of pleasure. I had almost completed number 13 of the series when I received a letter from the secretary, stating that in the opinion of certain people, the little publication was not sufficiently spiritual in character, and was not meeting the need for which it had been instituted. Also, she suggested that it would be better if I obtained some of our religious journals, selected items from them, and made up the book from these, and from stories of hymns and so on. I was astonished, perhaps a trifle piqued, for this was the very first intimation I had had that my work was not giving satisfaction. After careful consideration, I decided to retire from the job. If a snippings magazine were required, There were several such already printed in Braille by various religious organizations in England and America, and supplies could be purchased from these sources. Further, this kind of book could be got together by any intelligent seeing person and would not demand any original talent in the editor. Many such could be found, so I wrote and explained my views, and advised the committee to hand over the affair to someone who had access to such journals in ink print. So ended my task as compiler of the Book of Opals series. When the number of them is recalled, 12 in all, I fancy that I must have arrived at the same crossroads as clergymen who are said to be about worked out after 12 years of ministry in the same spot and among the same people. War conditions and the present shortage of paper would have cut out this work in any case. Yet I trust that when things are normal once more, the magazine of snippings, or something in its place, will go out to the dear charges of Robert Byer's mission and shine with a light more radiant than ever did my Book of Opals. Psychological. Now and then I come across a thoughtful individual venturesome enough to discuss with me the psychological aspect of blindness. How we feel toward the sighted, and how we find the sighted feel toward us. Generally I waive the subject, for I have not yet completely analyzed it for myself, and in addition I am sure my viewpoint would not be welcome to the listener. But perhaps something may be said here, for it is the psychological aspect which explains the persistent endeavour, the resolute resistance which carries the handicapped person through to self-realisation and worthy citizenship. As suggested, there are two sides to the question. First, how blind people look at life and their associations with the fully visioned. And second, how the seeing react to their intercourse with the blind. Take the first. When the eclipse of vision overtakes a person, there is usually a definite consciousness of defeat, of dependence, readily accepted by the very young children, but in adults rejected, even resented, with repugnance. To what extent the victim recovers from his state of mind is in direct ratio with the spirit and enterprise of the individual. For some slip quietly into reliance on others for everything, while the enlightened and courageous put up a fight against it. I have often noticed that the patient grow exacting and tyrannical and fret and complain when they do not get everything they demand. The reverse of this picture is the blind who resist the handicap, asking as little as possible from their friends and family, growing sweeter in patience, the genuine sort, through the cultivation of self-reliance that leads to justifiable self-esteem. Thus they learn to avoid exactions, have fewer grievances, and their relations with the world of the sighted become more and more cordial and friendly. Out of this arises a very near approach to normalcy, and the intercourse between blind and seeing attains the same social quality as if there were no handicap on either side. Thus, the one who sees forgets that the other cannot, and the non-seeing gets no inferiority complex, and the profits by the advantages of his friend. How happy such a relation can be, nobody knows better than the author of these lines, who is rich in intimacies of every possible kind, with just as many seeing as blind people. Some assert that the afflicted, including our group, are suspicious and distrustful. This I emphatically deny, save where the natural bent or temperament is such, in which case the person would have those bad qualities, whether handicapped or whole. I have known sightless folk who found it hard to accept surroundings and statements without question, but I believe there may have been a reason for that, which originated not in the afflicted one at all. I remember a simple incident, which might easily explain one case at least. I was visiting a blind friend one day, and she came from her room and asked her sister, "Is my apron quite clean?" The answer was, "Oh, yes." When the blind person went back to her bedroom, the other turned to a neighbour and remarked, "She's that fussy that I wouldn't tell her it was a bit soiled." I protested that the woman with perfect vision on whom her sister relied for the truth had fallen far below the necessary standard, and if her blind sister found out, it would not be surprising if she distrusted her in future. Many people think such fibs are justifiable, on the plea that they save us from pain or worry. But they cannot abrogate the right to deceive us, and we must have about us people who are absolutely trustworthy. Many a smile has crossed my face as I read authors who indulge their characters in such tricks, to show how pitiful are their heroes, and incidentally how stupid are the blind. They were Wilkie Collins in Poor Miss Finch, King Lear's guide on the False Cliff, and even our dear Charles Dickens, who made the father lie and cheat to blind Bertha about their home and his beautiful overcoat of sacking. It is a mystery that these great ethical writers should try to justify this kind of falsehood, and so deny the reality of their own ethics. I rejoice to say, however, that as a rule, you find good, reliable souls about the handicapped. Indeed, more than that, there is love and devotion very often. And if now and then some suspect and distrust their comrades, it is their unfortunate disposition, and the fault is no more prevalent among the blind than among the sound of body. Another psychological aspect which is propounded is whether blindness is a secret cause of grief and resentment. Of course, when a man is suddenly stricken and finds that the black shadow means loss of employment and income and great hardship to his wife and dependents, not to mention his own broken life, it must follow that he suffers bitterly. In his heart he may rage at his misfortune and curse God or fate, according to his views. But that passes, like all other miseries, and soon he begins to find that all the doors of perception are not closed, and roads along which he can advance are still beneath his feet. Those who are blind in early life have not to go through the readjustment process, and never feel the loss, save in very rare and exceptional circumstances. Hence, among all the hundreds of blind whom I have known, only a negligible minority have had to endure for long the pangs of resentment and sorrow. I guess most of these would have had an imaginary grievance, had the real one never come to their aid, for he who wants a cause for grumbling can always find one at hand. My sightless comrades are a very cheerful lot, full of fun, well endowed with a sense of humour, capable of enjoying all good things. Truly, they march along the road of life singing, even if the track be narrower than the way of the seeing.
And that brings us to the end of episode 12 of The Memoirs of Tilly Aston, published by Hawthorne Press and read by Pam Adams. This series was produced in the studios of 3RPH Melbourne for the RPH Network.